Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Justice must always question itself, just as society can exist only by means of the work it does on itself and on its institutions. The French philosopher Michel Foucault. Welcome back to Dead and Gone in Wyoming, a monthly podcast telling the stories of this remarkable state's most enduring murders and disappearances. I'm Scott Fuller, and coming up on this month's episode, quite simply, simple questions without easy answers. Was Jim Cooper a drug dealer? Following the fall of 1983, that question was top of mind for many residents of western Wyoming. The answer was undefined and unknown. With the speculation in place of knowing for sure what happened to Jim Cooper, namely where did he go, being inserted by each into their own narrative. Because, as we know, humans abhor a vacuum, but especially a vacuum of information. What is anxiety, if not the lack of certainty? We can't not know. It's in our nature, passed down in our DNA for hundreds of thousands of years. Human beings need to decide immediately if something is a threat or an asset. Is that rustling sound in the bushes there a predator or prey? With the advancement of modern society, that same biological need to answer every question immediately has vast and unavoidable ramifications. And when it comes to explaining a mystery without an answer, it means speculation. We are speculative creatures by nature. And so was Jim Cooper a drug dealer. Is that why Jim disappeared without a trace after a night out earlier in that fall of 83? Maybe it would explain why Jim disappeared. Maybe it wouldn't. But it didn't matter. So long as that narrative was there to cling to plug into the answer for the question. Or at the very least, serve as the answer to the question until the mystery was eventually solved. But for a very few others, Jim's friends in Wyoming and, of course, his family out west in California, the question was offensive, among other things, and added to the pain of his disappearance. For the better part of 40 years now, some of those questions have been answered, some haven't been, and some of the questions have been forgotten entirely. Eric James Cooper, who went by Jim, was most likely not a drug dealer, not in the sense that you're probably thinking, not a kingpin, anyway. But ask anyone who was there about drugs around Jackson Hole in the 80s, and you'll understand why that assumption persisted. Following a three-month investigation in September 1983, Jim was arrested and charged with delivery of marijuana. He was scheduled to appear before a judge on the 7th of November. He never showed up. So a week later, a judge ordered a bench warrant for his arrest, prompting police to begin an active search for the now fugitive, Eric James Jim Cooper. It didn't take long for police to figure out that something wasn't right. Now, on the one hand, this would be far from the first time that someone failed to appear for a scheduled court date, but on the other hand, people who make such decisions aren't usually that difficult to find. But Jim Cooper was, because he was nowhere, It was almost as though he'd vanished. Of course, it was possible that he fled, in anticipation of what was certain to be at least some kind of jail time that he'd face from the drug charge. But that didn't seem likely to investigators, not in this instance, at least not to those first investigators who were trying to find Jim after he failed to appear in court. After visiting the usual places that Jim was likely to be, police spoke to his friends and family, trying to track him down. And these people, your friends and family, if you're a fugitive, they usually give you up, like it or not. When push comes to shove, we can, each of us, probably count on one hand the number of people in our lives who would lie to law enforcement to protect our illicit decisions. And in certain cases, like Jim's, where some of those known associates that police are speaking to are themselves incentivized to keep law enforcement off their own track, well, you know what they say about honor among thieves. But not this time, though. Nobody law enforcement interviewed in regards to the 23-year-old Jim Cooper's failure to appear in court on November 7th gave police any indication that he'd fled, or that he was actively eluding, or that he was actually anywhere specifically at all. And that was unusual. So police sought the assistance of the public. They publicized their interest in finding 6'2", 170-pound Jim Cooper. A reward was offered, and money talks. And it turned out that Jim had been last seen 3 weeks before his scheduled court appearance, back on October 13th. He'd been seen by a few people at two Jackson bars. Witnesses remembered Cooper flashing what seemed to be an inordinate amount of cash for such establishments. And yes, just as it might be for you right now, for police, a picture of what else could have happened to their fugitive, even before he was one, began to emerge. Among the loves of Jim Cooper's life was his car. He was very prideful of his black Dodge Charger. I can't say for certain, but I would imagine it being the only such vehicle parked at the Wagon Wheel Trailer Park, where Jim lived. But that's not where police found it. Some days after Cooper had been last seen, but weeks before police were looking for the man himself, Jim's Dodge Charger was found parked at the Virginian Saloon in Jackson. There are a few scenarios that one might surmise from this scene on that night, which might have perhaps been Jim's last in Jackson, Wyoming. One scenario might be that he was out on the town celebrating or commemorating what he knew would be his last local hurrah. Flush with cash from suing a restaurant where he'd broken a tooth, and with a looming court date just a few weeks away, Jim Cooper planned a course of action to get out ahead of the law, and he fled the very next day. His family had ties to California. Stands to reason he might have gone west. Other rumors were already swirling that he'd instead gone south to Florida with a woman he knew in town. Because this is what we do when people go missing, especially when they're on the run from the law, or seem to be. And something within us hopes that they're not caught. Deep down, we know they'll eventually be caught. We need them to be caught, really. It's one of the stitches holding society together that people can't just commit crimes and run away, but admit that you've caught yourself rooting for Jesse James or Bonnie or Clyde, even though you already know how the story ends. But Jim Cooper was never caught. And so whether he was a hardened drug dealer or just a casual recreational user, it was easy to imagine in 1983 and 1984 that he'd just run away. Nobody who knew Jim Cooper believed that, though. Not when they learned that his car had been found. Had Jim Cooper fled, in anticipation of what, by the way, would likely not have been a very serious sentence for the marijuana anyway, every single person who knew the man, including his parents, believed that he would have run away in his prized black Dodge Charger. So certain were his parents of this belief that they were forced into an unimaginable realization and into a place that no parent would willingly wander. Their son was murdered. For what or how or by whom, nobody knew, but Jim was gone. Because his car wasn't. From this certainty that their son had become the victim of a homicide, Stephen Louise Cooper offered $1,000 in reward money for information leading to the arrest of their son's killer. They also had a pertinent question of police. When Jim's car had been found at the bar in Jackson, it was true that he wasn't yet a wanted man, but still, where was the curiosity from the Jackson PD? They wondered. They'd found an abandoned car at a bar, which apparently had been there for a few days by that point. But what about the driver? Who was he? Where was he? Where was the follow-up on what should have been perhaps the beginning stages of a separate missing persons investigation? That's what Jim's parents wanted to know as 1983 became 1984, and as time passed, amidst their certainty of foul play in their son's case, they had more questions, and darker ones. In the meantime, local law enforcement defended their handling of the investigation and their actions following the discovery of Cooper's car. Police said, first of all, Jackson's a transient place. It's a tourist town, and it's not at all unusual for anyone, local or not, to not be seen for an extended period of time. They also said they did try to locate Cooper following the discovery of his car at the bar by sending a deputy to visit his trailer, where obviously Jim Cooper was not. After he failed to appear in court, Cooper's information was entered into a regional computer database used by law enforcement in several western states at the time, in the event that he turned up somewhere else in the region. It is true that local PD had not called on state investigators or their forensic resources to investigate Cooper's car or his trailer as potential crime scenes, but that was because there hadn't been any evidence of a crime occurring against Jim Cooper, police said. The bottom line from the perspective of law enforcement was that Jim Cooper had fled ahead of his likely prosecution for a pending drug case. And by August of 1984, that belief had hardened to a near certainty within the Jackson Police Department. Part of the reason for that steadfastness was that in the intervening months, Cooper's family had traveled all over the West, handing out missing persons flyers to anybody who would take one. One of those flyers found its way to Ogden, Utah. Two residents there immediately recognized the missing man portrayed as Jim Cooper to be a person they knew to be EJ. This EJ was an acquaintance of these people, and so they called the police number on the flyer. Jackson police traveled to Ogden, Utah, where they interviewed not just those two witnesses, but four other people who knew the man going by EJ. They all said Jim Cooper and this EJ were one in the same. Apparently, he was no longer in town, but the combined witness sightings from no less than six people in Utah of Jim Cooper apparently operating under an alias was enough to convince Jackson police that Cooper was indeed alive and on the run and evading detection, or at least trying to. With that, back home in Wyoming, a spokesman for the Jackson Police Department proclaimed, 9 months after he'd been seen there, that Jim Cooper was definitely alive and was believed to be hiding somewhere in California. Signal Mountain in the Grand Teton National Park is one of the more popular destinations in that national park because it's a passable trail for hikers of all ages, and the trek is paid off by remarkable views of the jagged Teton Mountains in the distance. And for this reason, it's often crowded. Plenty of people passed onto and up and down from Signal Mountain in the summers of 1984 and 85 and 86. But the vast majority of those park visitors stay on the main trails and the roads, as they should, by the way. But kids don't always do that. Kids tend to wander. There was a 7-year-old boy visiting the Tetons from Australia and meandering about 150 feet off the main road leading to the Signal Mountain trailhead within the national park who found the skull. It first appeared to the boy to be a white rock with a hole in it, and that boy could have just as easily continued on adventuring without telling anybody about the white rock that he saw that day. But the boy investigated the white rock and realized it wasn't. So the boy walked back to his parents and, to their horror, told them, quote, "I found a human head." Frantically, the boy's mother called police. Bones in the woods in Wyoming aren't necessarily notable. Obviously, human remains are notable, but human remains found in that area, in the Tetons especially, are something else, too. They're ambiguous. An uncomfortable number of people go missing every year in our national parks and forests. And so when a 7-year-old tourist finds a set of human bones, they're not necessarily immediately explainable like they might be if they were found some other place in the country. Whose bones are they? It's a more difficult question to answer than you might think, because people go missing in the Tetons. Did those remains found in the Tetons belong to an English mountain climber who hadn't been seen since 1981? Were the bones those of a hunter from Montana who disappeared under suspicious circumstances in 1979? Officials didn't know right away. All the county sheriff's department knew for certain was that the bones were male, belonging to a 20 to 40-year-old man, and that the remains that had been found in the woods had been there for about 3 to 10 years, they said. They knew one more thing for certain, too. Those bones did not belong to Eric James Cooper, Jim Cooper, missing from Jackson since 1983. County officials ruled out the remains as being Jim's by comparing dental records, they said. 2.5 weeks later, experts from the Wyoming Crime Lab said differently. The bones found 150 feet off the main road to Signal Mountain were those of Jim Cooper. So what did the Wyoming Crime Lab do differently that police in Jackson weren't able to accomplish? How did they identify the remains as Jim Cooper's? Dental records. Yeah. Let me just say this about homicide investigation. It is vital and difficult work. Very often, police are the only voices for the victims in many cases. And there's only one benchmark for success, namely arrest the murderer. Way easier said than done. And every intervening day between that time when the crime occurs and the perpetrator is arrested, there is endless opportunity for victims' friends and family and the public to criticize and blindly second-guess an ongoing investigation. Meanwhile, part of that investigation, a very integral part, is often making sure that the public not know some of the progress that's being made in the investigation. You might be doing all kinds of things behind the scenes and the public doesn't know about it. So the perception might be that you're not doing anything. Some of that information until a case is ready for prosecution, if it becomes public, it would undermine said prosecution, especially if it becomes known before the suspect has even been arrested. Add to that that police and sheriff's departments, all law enforcement really, are further public employees, as of course they should be. But public employees must politic in order to continue their careers and advance their careers. Sheriffs are typically elected. Chiefs of police are appointed by elected people. So this is a job that not only needs to get done, but it needs to get done in a form and fashion that pacifies most of the voting population in a place that, by the way, may or may not have any level of pre-existing confidence in its civic institutions, including police departments. And one last thing, this is a job that needs to get done that is just one of hundreds of other jobs that a law enforcement agency must investigate and help prosecute every year just to keep the peace and dodge. So for all those reasons and more, I can be seen as an apologist for law enforcement, and it could be that I am. But to whatever extent I tend to err when in doubt on the side of police, I also have a firmly journalistic bent. And journalism effectively has one charge: question institutional authority. And obviously, some questions stand out in response to the Jackson Police and the Jackson County Sheriff to the discovery of Jim Cooper's remains. First of all, 2 years prior to the bones being found, nearly 2 years to the day, actually, law enforcement stood up and publicly and proudly proclaimed that Jim Cooper was alive, and he's somewhere, probably California, but he most certainly was not, on that very day, dead in the Tetons. Even by that point, police had been sparring in the press with Cooper's parents, who had been extremely critical of the Jackson PD for not taking the case seriously as a missing persons case, dating back to when Jim's car had been found parked outside the bar. The department responded in defense of itself, and perhaps in the process became even more entrenched in a convenient outcome. That convenient outcome would, of course, have been that police were right. Jim Cooper had fled fearing prosecution. He was alive. And then in Cooper's parents questioning the veracity of the investigation and through it, the department as a whole, is simply boiled down to this: they just didn't know what they were talking about. The disbelieving, wishful thinking of parents of a criminal fugitive, not the mother and father of a murder victim. Then, Jim's bones were found. Jackson Police and the Sheriff's Department did not respond with, "Well, let's wait and see, it might be Jim." The response instead was, "Let's wait and see, but 100% for sure these bones are not Jim Cooper's." Supposedly, this first elimination made by police in Jackson was through dental records. The examination there was so accurate that it was immediately overturned by state investigators, using the same evidence. And things, I mean, might be a little bit fishier than that even, like the local department's initial examination of the bones that were found. Police said the bones belonged to a male aged 20 to 40, and they'd been in the woods for anywhere between 3 and 10 years. 3 to 10 years seems to me quite the margin for such a estimation. And that 3 to 10 window would be enough for police to include the two other unsolved disappearances, those of the English hiker and the Montana hunter, who had disappeared 5 and 7 years before, respectively. The remains, in fact, had been in the woods for 3 years. That age range of a male aged 20 to 40 also conveniently encompasses not just Jim Cooper, but the other two missing cases. And then, I hate to bring it up now, but Also, the state finding contradicting Jackson police and confirming that those bones were Jim Cooper's, those results were kept quiet for an additional week so that police in Jackson could, quote, gather additional information for a joint murder investigation, end quote. That extra week also allowed Jackson PD to attempt to get back in front of a homicide investigation that to this point, the agency as a whole had effectively denied even existing. It is worth noting, looking back through the record now, that when it comes to the Cooper investigation, not everybody in the Jackson Police Department or the Sheriff's Office were on the same page from day one. Some officers were suspicious of the case right away, and they thought it might be a potential homicide pretty much from day one. Even after the trip to Utah to interview a half dozen witnesses who swore that Jim Cooper was this mysterious EJ that they knew out there. This obviously, by the way, was not the case, we know now, but even then, some Jackson investigators still questioned whether Jim Cooper might have somehow met with foul play. But from a departmental standpoint, the message was simple and clear. Jim Cooper was alive and in hiding, and that was that, until a 7-year-old boy went on a hike. Now 3 years behind the trail, Teton County investigators descended on the woods where Cooper's remains had been found, and they searched for any minute clues in the woods for days. The bones that were found revealed that Eric James Cooper had been shot once in the head. From Jackson, Wyoming, there's a state highway that leads northeast for a time until it meets Signal Hill Road. And it was beginning to appear that Jim Cooper, probably on that night, was driven up that main highway and onto a national park road for another 2 miles, where eventually his body was disposed of about 30 or 40 yards into the woods. From the evidence, there's no way to know where Jim Cooper was killed or precisely when. It would eventually be revealed by investigators that a pair of sneakers had also been found at the Signal Mountain location, and that the bones had been found along with plastic wrapping and some rope. Investigators also found an enigmatic piece of cloth at the scene, but they couldn't quite place its origin. It fell to the county coroner to call Jim's parents in California and notify them of the discovery of their son. Publicly critical of the investigation to that point, Mr. and Mrs. Cooper reportedly expressed relief at finally receiving some kind of closure in their son's case, at least according to the account of the coroner. Police at the time refused to say whether Cooper's death was being investigated as a drug-related homicide. 20 years went by, and for the 20 Wyoming tourist seasons and the 20 Wyoming winters that followed, during all that time, a .22 caliber handgun had remained locked within a bank safety deposit box in Jackson, Wyoming. In August 2005, the ownership of that safety deposit box changed hands, and the box was drilled into, revealing the gun. How many reasons are there to have a gun in a safety deposit box for 20 years? Just like that, Jackson PD reopened the Cooper case, and they let out more of the case file to the public. They said Jim Cooper had been shot with a .22, and the bullet itself had been recovered, although the slug had been all but obliterated. It was now theorized by police that Cooper was shot somewhere near Jackson, and then driven 45 miles into the national park, where his body, wrapped in plastic, was dumped in the woods. The gun inside the bank was reportedly still in excellent to pristine condition, and officials were hopeful that residue and other physical evidence from the weapon was still testable, and so they sent the gun and other evidence in the case off to the FBI. And a new theory began to emerge among a new generation of Jackson homicide detectives, that this murder weapon had been locked up for 2 decades, and maybe it belonged to someone with information about Jim Cooper's death. Perhaps he was a witness or a party himself to the killing. And that .22 was this person's Wild West insurance policy of sorts. If anything happened to this person, that murder weapon would eventually be found, and it would lead to Jim Cooper's killer. Time may have made the Jim Cooper killing cold, but county authorities probably won't describe it to you that way, because new leads have always come in this case. There was the terrified confession of someone who themselves told police they were in fact the confessor of Jim's killer. This person came forward out of fear that after being told by Cooper's killer, they were going to be killed. But this person was also considered unreliable by some in law enforcement. Others have come forward to police linking Cooper's death to other seemingly drug-related cases in Jackson throughout the 80s. We've talked a little about that in past episodes of the podcast. That piece of cloth that was found with Cooper's bones in the Grand Teton National Park was eventually determined to have come from one of Jim's own shirts, a t-shirt he'd gotten while working a concert in 1982. Some of the detectives who currently work Jim Cooper's homicide were in elementary school at the time he was killed. And sadly, Jim Cooper's parents have both passed away. What, if anything, that gun in the bank had to do with Jim Cooper's death has never been revealed. The 7-year-old boy who found Jim Cooper's bones in the woods that day became a Los Angeles police officer. Today, he cites that morbid discovery of bones in the woods on vacation in Wyoming as the reason he decided to pursue a career in law enforcement. Jim Cooper's case remains unsolved today, 38 years since he was last seen. Now the chances of Jim Cooper's death ever being tried in a courtroom are growing slimmer and slimmer by the year, but police do have several persons of interest in this case. And authorities have stated many times their belief that Jim Cooper's killer remained alive and living in Jackson the whole time. Thank you for listening to this episode of Dead and Gone in Wyoming. Sources for this episode include the Jackson Hole Guide, the Jackson Hole News, that was back before they merged into one newspaper, as well as the Casper Star Tribune, among others. Thanks to all of you for your patience in the time since our last main feed episode came out. I recently underwent what seems to have been successful surgery. I'm finally back to feeling human again, so hopefully we're back now more on a normal schedule. Of course, you can stay up to date with the show on Patreon, and thanks to the supporters we have there who make the production of this show possible. You can also follow me on Twitter, @WyomingPodcast. And whether it's there or via email, I love to hear your feedback on each episode, the series, whatever's on your mind, including ideas for future stories. That's WyomingPodcast@gmail.com. Sadly, that's all the time we have for this month. And so for all the great people at County10.com, I'm Scott Fuller, already looking forward to bringing you the next episode of Dead and Gone in Wyoming.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.